Hey there, and you're very welcome to episode 6 of Triton Lake Perform. My name is Connor Smith, founder and CEO of Triton Lake, a marketplace connecting sophisticated investors with differentiated alternative investment opportunities. In 2021, Triton Lake became the title sponsor of the Ireland men's and women's rugby sevens teams. This podcast explores the intersections of sport and business, looking at what both worlds can learn from each other and what are the key parts to the puzzle of high performance. We have heard from expert performers both on and off the playing field over the past few months, and we're excited to welcome another fantastic guest to our Triton Lake Perform podcast. Today, we're delighted to be joined by Lynn Cantwell. Lynn is the most capped women's rugby player in Ireland, and since retiring from the game, she has gone on to chair the Sport Ireland Women in Sport Committee, and last year took up a role as the South African Rugby's High Performance Manager for Women's Rugby. You're very welcome, Lynn.
Yeah, thank you. No, thanks for having me.
Maybe to get started, tell us a little bit about what your role encompasses today with South African Rugby.
So I'm with South African Rugby. I'm the Women's High Performance Manager for the women's game here. So that is kind of essentially responsible for the national programs and the national programs pathway at a kind of junior 15s and 7s level. But equally, we've taken a broader approach to look at the development of the game as well, to create a developmental pipeline to fuel all of the national programs as well. So it's quite a broad role.
So maybe tell us a little bit about how the role came about, Lynn, moving from a high performance role in Ireland to one in South Africa.
Yeah, like any of these kind of things, it's a little bit of timing. Probably I think in the women's sport world and in the women's rugby world, I think it's probably quite a small community. And when you see any country or code that is ambitious about women's sport or women's rugby, it's quite exciting, regardless of what nationality you are. Like I'm Irish through and through, you know, and I love my identity and definitely was a big motivator in who I am and who I represented in how I played. But I think at an organizational level, when you see an organization that is committed at a leadership level to a future of the women's game and quite serious about it and are open to the women's rugby and women's sports insights. And what I mean by that is, you know, having that eureka moment at an organizational level where you recognize in order for us to build a sustainable women's game or women's sport, knowing that it differs to the men's and really wanting to acknowledge that and find out what that is and how we build it. Like, that's a really, really important point. So I think, you know, when South Africa reached out, that was the point that they were at. You know, they tried one or two things and they recognized, look, we're just getting something wrong here. The stuff we don't know in the women's game, and we're trying to copy and paste and it's just not working. So like, that's a really lovely place to be. And I think from a family point of view, you know, we were probably at a stage of timing. We were living in London at that time. We were about to move back home to Ireland to kind of set up sticks. You know, we kind of two young kids. So probably in a transition period ourselves, and this opportunity came about. So yeah, one of those things. And we said, look, we'll jump on this adventure and see how it goes.
See how it goes. Good timing on both sides, it sounds like. And how did your own rugby journey, I guess, help you in this current role and lead you towards this direction of high performance?
Yeah, look, I definitely don't think you need to be a player to step into these roles. But at the same time, probably in the women's game, because of the different nuances in the women's game, having those experiences and knowing a lot about what it's like to be a women's sports person and trying to kind of aspire and achieve and having kind of walked that walk, as well as kind of just having that natural interest afterwards to explore more, to try and understand what's in the way of women's sport doing better. And they were probably kind of the two things that stood me well. So there's obviously just that basic experience from a player point of view. But probably what that wouldn't give you is the kind of the leadership and business and kind of strategic stuff that you need in a role like that, which I suppose my own kind of natural interest and just my kind of professional experience aside being a player, probably kind of teed that up well enough to take on the role. So yeah, look, I think one thing I've noticed since coming over here, and I say it all the time, I acknowledge straight away, look, I'm not South African. What I do know probably a lot about the women's game, and I know the insights, and I know what I think we know what it needs, but I need that to be translated in this South African culture and context. You know, there's 11 different cultures over here and 11 different languages, and I'm definitely not saying that I understand what that is like. So I need that to be translated. So hopefully the blend of it is making a difference. Yeah, but we'll see how it goes.
Absolutely. If maybe stay on the theme a little bit of your playing career, how did, in those days, I guess, how did you ensure that your performance was as good as it could be?
Oh, look, I think that's a journey for everybody, isn't it? And I think you change. It's an age and stage thing. Like, I think when I started, I was an athlete, so I was a sprinter. So I came in, you know, like most people did at that stage. I went to UL, started rugby there. Munster, just an incredible province, obviously, and a really liberal province when it came to playing rugby. So there's no blockers for girls to play, which was great. So I think initially when I started, I was just fast, you know, I was just fast, explosive, competitive, and that type of player. I think as I grew, I grew into just having a natural curiosity around getting better. And I think what that looked like is at a technical, tactical level, really interested in, you know, we're here now, what don't we know, how do we get better? And that's probably where my interest always sat and stood. Like, naturally, we soldiered for a long, long time and probably didn't go through an awful lot of nice things, but equally, you know, galvanized us definitely as a group. And you know, thankfully, we were able to produce what we produced by the end of it. You know, and that's a lovely story. And no doubt we wouldn't have been able to do that if we hadn't have gone through what we had gone through. But I think where I ended up at a personal level and a leadership level was just still always driven and motivated by that curiosity of getting better on the pitch. And that's probably where I sat. You know, I wasn't the type of person who wanted to speak all the time or wanted to be in the spotlight. I was just naturally just really curious. How do we get better? How do we get better? And kind of driven that way. So I think that was kind of my contribution to that story.
No, the next question I was going to ask was, what are the attributes and characteristics that made you fit well in the high performance environment? But it sounds like the, you know, curiosity and a willingness to learn and improve was a big part. But do you think the athletics and the sprinting side, was there a discipline around that maybe that also in your training you were able to transfer across?
Yeah, definitely, Connor. Look, I think, you know, you, when you're a bit older, you reflect lots on bits and bobs. And you know, my combination is by all accounts not, you know, not a gold standard one. It's just my mesh of what's brought me to this point. And I've made plenty of mistakes and blunders along the way and still do. I definitely think my work ethic is a huge part of it, though. And I probably just recognize that, yes, there was an athletics piece there. Being an individual athlete, you know, there's nowhere to hide. You're completely accountable, completely for your own performance. And when I came into a team sport, I definitely noticed that, you know, the dynamics of what you focus on in team sports are very different to the individual kind of athletic focuses that you have as an individual sports person. Like, I have to say, and I know this probably sounds a bit corny, but like, my mom and dad were incredibly hard workers, and we kind of had a setup at home where my mom always wanted to be there for us when we came home from school. So she worked at night and my dad worked during the day. So I think in our household, like, we had a wonderful upbringing, but I think in our household, people are always going, like, they're always working, you know. And I think it's only reflecting back on that now and probably how I juggle my life and family and where you find the time to do things. But I think that's probably one thing that has stood me well, is just a hard work ethic. And as you say, through the athletics, I think what I built up through my teens was like a very kind of robust body that knew how to push hard that thankfully didn't get injured ever. And I think that allowed me just to keep building, you know, as opposed to having interruptions, which you can do.
And you know, if you think about, you're talking about juggling and those kind of things, if you think about, you know, what was an amateur game then, right, and a career as an amateur player, what fueled your commitment to it and all the training beyond wanting to learn and the curiosity and everything else? There must have been something that drove the commitment to rugby, right?
Yeah, that's a funny one. Like as a person, I think, and again, I probably know more about myself now than I did then. But I am a very probably intuitive person. I probably embrace it more now than I did back then. And I genuinely was motivated by fun. Like I love the feeling of running around in a pitch with my friends, trying to find space, sprinting through it, you know. So I think I loved the thrill of playing, of that, just that kind of physical thrill. I think what motivates you to keep going, as I said, is the curiosity and interest of building and getting better, and that fascination of that kind of mastery curve. But you know, it's such a cliche, but you know, the girls around you and the people around you were incredible. You know, that group of players that we grew up with you know, Fiona Coughlin and Joy Neville and Grace Davis and all of those girls. You know, we were in it together, and you know, nobody would drop out because you were committed towards each other. I suppose you were committed to each other. Yeah, and before you know it, time passes by and you're a decade long in something, and yeah, hopefully achieving something good.
No, absolutely. And what learnings, I guess, from those days did you take into your life outside of rugby, into professional realm, and to what you're doing today? What were the key bits that stood out for you?
We've probably kind of touched on a couple of them. You know, your hard work ethic, your not necessarily attention to detail, but probably standards, you know. I probably feel like at an intuitive level, I care, you know, what people are going through, and you know what we're going through, and I think it's important that we talk about things. And I think on the pitch, and that might be just I don't think it's actually a female thing. I think it's a really important thing for guys too, because I think when I think about how close you can get as a group, or as a pair, or as a backline, as a full team. There's so many things that happen and go wrong in a pitch on a 2 monthly or 2 minute basis. You know, if we can problem solve and talk that through and figure out like what went wrong there, what were we trying to do? Where was the space? How do we do it better next time? Or notice when somebody's having a bad day, like what's going on? Like how can we fix it? You know, I think like I notice a lot of that stuff. And I probably practically, again, reflecting back on it now, I think where we were as a group is that we were very tight, but we were tight by genuinely loving each other, you know,
absolutely.
And caring about each other, and noticing about each other. So that kind of stuff I do bring into my professional life. I think people are incredible. I think they're incredibly complex, but I'm interested in that. Like, don't get me wrong, this role is huge, and I probably struggle sometimes to know how fast we're moving, and I wish we could slow down to notice more what people are going through, because people are really key in what we're doing. But at the same time, it doesn't stop me picking up what people are going through and seeing. And definitely I enjoy, like some people don't enjoy having different conversations. I definitely enjoy asking people, is something not right with you? Let's have a chat about it, you know? So that's probably one of the key things I think I've taken away from it.
No, it's an interesting one. And it's one, you know, when we spoke to Lucy Mulhall talking about the current Ireland women's sevens here, it was a point that came very strongly across, the, you know, the care they have for each other on and off the pitch. And that enables them to be vulnerable, I guess, right? And to be accountable and everything that comes with that. And that can only lead to better performance. Maybe thinking about women's rugby in general a bit, and there's obviously been a lot of change, but since your time on the pitch, what are some of the major changes that you've noted in terms of performance and the ask on women, I guess?
Yeah, look, there's probably kind of two main things. You know, at a women's rugby level, if we just focus on rugby, you're recognizing its developmental curve is really, really key. Like it is a young sport, and as a result, there's a build. Like we are in an infrastructure build phase whereby we need to build performance environments. Ultimately, you know, although Fijians and so other nationalities around the world probably find a magic system that doesn't involve those kind of performance blocks that other systems do. But like ultimately you need to create a performance environment that enables athletes to plug in on a daily basis to train hard, to recover hard, to get better, to analyze, to ask questions, you know, to remain curious. So I think the infrastructure build that we're in is key. And what that looks like is yes, every national team has to have experienced head coaches. They have to have good S&Cs that know preseason, postseason, in season, how to periodize. You know, you have to have a medical system that enables players to stay on the pitch and to get back onto the pitch when they get off it. You know, you have to have leadership and commitment at a financial and budgetary level. You know, and they're all, that's what a performance environment is. So I think in the women's game, we're still building that. And what differs from where I was to what there is now, there's probably more of it. You know, we had that system, but we put it in place ourselves. You know, it wasn't handed to us. And you'll speak to lots. I've spoken to Dervla O'Rourke before as well. And, you know, the system that she created around herself in order to perform and do what she did was a self-build type of a system. So there's, you know, plenty of athletes and examples of who's done it, but it's definitely easier if you're in an advanced system that has, you know, so you've got athletes that are coming up at a 17, 18 level and they're plugging into a performance system and then they're just going to clock up the years and just naturally be better. So that's probably one thing that's differed. We have more awareness of that and just more sponsorship. And like, that's quite corporate talk, but there is more of that. And probably what we have more of, but this is, I think, a competitive advantage for countries who want to know this stuff versus some who are committing to the women's game just because they kind of have to, but they don't really, really spend time wondering, you know, what are the differences in the women's game and, you know, what do we need to do differently in order for it to thrive? So the difference, I think, is we know more of the female nuances and we know how women differ at a physical, emotional, psychological, practical level. And the countries and the codes that are tapping into that or researching that or are applying the research that we know and being brave to put spends in areas that in the women's game that don't exist in the men's game or do it differently and not see it as an expense, see it as this is an important nuance that we include in this program in order for females to flow through without any blockers. I think they're the things we know more of that stuff now than we did at the time that we had. But I think the thing we had when we were around was good people who actually cared and were flexible to those things and didn't shut them down just because it was different to the guys, you know. So there was probably a little bit of, you know, coaches and so on that were very, very, very non-threatened by kind of peer-driven and player-driven feedback and game plans and stuff like that, which I think is a real good thing in the women's game. You know, that co-creation, that collaboration in the women's game is key compared to the guys' game, which is a little bit more alpha. And, you know, let's do what I say and let's follow this game plan. Whereas in the women's game, I think what we're definitely noticing is players have it been included in the conversation and creating it itself definitely seems to be a nuance, which I think actually is just sports specific. And I'd imagine that men's game is going to evolve and to capitalize on that stuff too. But yeah, that's just one example of the nuances of the women's game that I think we captured back then.
No, absolutely. And I think that makes a lot of sense. And obviously the management and staff have more resources now, as you mentioned, and hopefully a lot more information at their hands as well. But how have the roles of the players changed, I guess, over that time period? Or is it the same, just with better support around them? How have you seen that change?
Yeah, that's an interesting one, because I think what's great from a player's point of view, and, you know, we're all campaigning for more contracts and full-time approaches, et cetera, to the women's game. And therefore, I suppose the player's role will be a bit more focused on, you know, this is my job and I have to get better at this. And I have therefore more time to get better in it and more time to recover and therefore will get better quicker. So that's probably one thing. I think because women's sport in general is more visible, I think girls can probably see more role models now. And what you're probably seeing lots of is younger girls acting like elite female athletes more. And that technically is a good thing. I think one thing that we have to be conscious of is moving too fast without staying grounded to like what it takes to be like just a robust female athlete and a male athlete. And that's the hard work, isn't it? Like you can't fake performance. You just have to be a damn grafter. And that often takes a long, long time. You can't just kind of snap your fingers and you get it just because you say the right things because you've seen other female athletes do it. So I think our challenge in the women's game going forward, and probably just the men's game too, because things are happening so quick and social media is so accessible, And there definitely is an entitlement culture that's around. I think the codes and the countries that allow their athletes to stay grounded to who they are, to allow them time to experience who they are as a person, as a player, and figure that out. And that's a wonderful thing. It's okay if that takes time, as opposed to just having ready-made athletes that plug into systems and are suddenly there. You know, I think as a leadership level, we have to be careful with that.
No, absolutely. And we touched on a minute ago the information that's in the hands of the staff and management today, and it kind of leads on to a question. It seems like the use of data is increasingly important in training, in the games, and everything has been measured. And what role do you see it playing from the high performance perspective, and how much do you read into it? And, you know, we talk about things like empathy and everything else, but I guess still alongside that, you're looking at a lot of numbers, right?
Yeah, look, the data science piece is really interesting, and it's a great space in sport, full stop, as well as women's sport. And I think why it's an important era for it in women's sport is because we know that we haven't got a lot of it. I think like 90% of all the sports data we have in the world is conducted on male athletes, and we're assuming and we're applying lots of principles to the women's game and assuming lots, and no doubt 60% of it will stick, and no doubt there'll be 40, 50% of it that'll differ. So excited about that space. I suppose, you know, we're seeing lots on, you know, we know that females experience concussions an awful lot different than men. We know that female athletes develop at a different rate, mainly based on their training age. You know, it's not necessarily, I think we kind of blame females' body shape a lot for increased injury risks, but I think a lot of it's developmental age. You know, we see that girls are not getting access to the kind of loading patterns that guys do because just simply the pathways aren't there at 12, 13, 14, which means that guys at 18, 19 can take the high intensity loads at a senior soccer or football match. And girls seem to be kind of popping ACLs here and there. And I think we're assuming that, girls, our bodies are made differently and therefore we have to be careful. And I think lots of it's based on just training age and access to things. So I think data will help us an awful lot more there. You know, there's lots more data on, you know, on periods, on maternity, on postpartum, all of these things that if we know more about it, I think we'll create way better systems that just enable women to be represented, to feel like they belong, to be represented in sport more, and therefore we'll just get more and more coming through and more performance. So I think it's a really exciting probably 5-10 years ahead.
Absolutely. Maybe we'll go back to South Africa again for a minute. I was going to say Ireland and South Africa offer very different cultures and work environments. It sounds a little bit from what you said, like you've gone from one culture and work environment to another work environment, but a handful of cultures, right? How have you found that, and what kind of differences have you seen, I suppose, as you face off to some of those different cultures?
Yeah, do you know what, Connor? It's been real. It's been incredible. And I kind of feel like, although I've been working with Saru for 2 years, you know, we were largely in Ireland for the first year of it because it was all kind of COVID lockdown stuff, and it was just over and back when flights allowed. And I kind of feel like this year my head is just buzzing, you know, and I just feel like we've got nine days before the Sevens World Cup here, and then 24 days before we go to the 15s World Cup in New Zealand. And I really feel like in December I'll sit down and have a good reflect and kind of think, well, because I even feel like my brain isn't clear in lots of the things that I'm thinking, which is kind of unusual. So I feel like the impact of plunking myself in this country, I'm still absorbing all of the information. I think what I see, as I mentioned, is 11 different cultures, 11 different languages, and we're coming from a country which we all kind of, you know, look the same and think the same and use the same words and stuff like that. And as a result, this principle of how do we flex to represent different types of people is really, really key. So I'm learning lots about that. I'm learning lots about, you know, if you don't speak a language, how do people understand what you're saying? How can they learn? How do you relate to them? How do you understand their culture more? How do you understand what they've been through in their lives more to be able to communicate effectively with them? I think, and what I think you say in Ireland and in Europe, what I noticed in this diversity and inclusion talk, you know, where gender is such a big part of it, what you're trying to convince people is that we different people do things differently, you know, but it's hard when we all are the same to kind of convince people that there's another way of looking at it. But like fundamental to this diversity and inclusion talk is that we all can look at things differently, and that's okay. And let's create a system that enables that instead of kind of judging it. So I think what I feel like I'm in at the moment is just an experience of like most things that we do, literally most things that we do will be picked up in a room differently by 7 or 8 different cohorts of people. So what you find practically how that plays out is, you know, like surveys that I will send to the girls at the end of a competition, I'll send it out in 3 different languages because the girls need to know that it's important that they speak a different language. They need to maybe read it differently through the language, and I need to get that information. And we need to go through loads of different mediums to ensure that we're getting to the essence of what the girls are thinking and feeling. So that's probably a simple example of it. That's probably my biggest observation of the time here is difference and embrace the difference. And I like looking at it that way. I remember seeing a quote, what does it say? Like, the one thing we all have in common is that we're different. And I loved that before I came to South Africa, but I think I understand it more now.
No, exactly. I mean, out of curiosity, are you dealing with a pool of players that are all under the South African Rugby Union, or do you have to face off to the individual regions and provinces? How does that bit work?
Yeah, look, I'm kind of getting my head around it. So in our national team, we've national players, and they're all from different parts of South Africa. But South Africa has 15 different provinces. Like, obviously at home, we have 4. And each of them will have their own, you know, CEOs and organizations like Bulls and Stormers and Sharks and so on. So one of my jobs centrally, like, for example, what we're trying to build at the moment is an elite women's league. So I'm working with all of the CEOs of those provinces to try and kind of motivate them to invest domestically in the women's game. That's something that happens. But then nationally, we have our national program where we're dealing with all the players that come from different parts of the country.
Okay. And if you think about the performance role that you have now, versus performance roles that you've had in Ireland or elsewhere, feels a little bit to me like South Africa is a little bit behind the curve. Is that fair to say? And you've more of an opportunity to put your stamp on things. Is that accurate?
Yeah, definitely. And like anything, I suppose you benefit sometimes from coming to the party a bit later for information. So that's cool. So we can definitely apply a lot of insights into here, and then the readiness to want to hear it and the readiness to put it into practice is like a really lovely combination. So I think that they definitely are, there's huge economic reasons why they're behind as well. And, you know, that's not going away quickly either. Like 70% of our players as well are African Black players from kind of relatively underprivileged areas as well. So the corporate model that we spoke about before, about, you know, how players get better, there's lots of other different challenges that we deal with those players, like, you know, just getting them to train in with transport and things like that. So that's something I hadn't experienced before, which is something we're trying to build. But in general, it is further behind. But like, as I said, what I've noticed, if you're truly committed and ambitious about the women's game and want to do best by it, and that commitment at a leadership level is there, things can move very, very quickly. And I think that's probably what I'm noticing and one of the advantages. Whereas I think in other countries, we probably have more examples of, you know, the system is there, but there's not the true commitment behind it. And therefore, it'll keep trundling along there, but, you know, at what pace? And other countries are probably going to pass it out.
Pass it out, yeah. No, absolutely. And maybe just take a brief step outside of rugby for a minute. And if you think about women in sport in general, you played a major role in the Women in Sport Committee. Where do you see the focus going forward generally for women in sport in Ireland?
Yeah, look, I think Ireland is doing so incredibly well for, you know, our little country that it is, you know. And if I think the women in sport policy that started, and, you know, it's the third year that it's in it now, it's expiring at the end of the year. Well, technically the policy, well, not that it comes to an end, but you know, we always said we reviewed at the end of the third year, so we're evaluating at that. And a big focus, for us at the start, obviously the core pillars were leadership and governance and coach and participation, visibility and leadership and governance. I think it's just that the phase that we're in, the era that we're in is representation at a board level and at leadership level is key because of the things that I think I just said there. So I think what Ireland has done incredibly well in, and I think hopefully we had a small part to play in it, is really pushing the board representation kind of targets over the line, you know, that we were fumbling at about at 10, 15% representation of female on national boards. And like, that's just ridiculous, you know, going back to the diversity inclusion conversation that we had there, like, you know, how are we going to progress and represent all of the country if who's representing our whole sports are one of the same person, you know, on a board. And so I think we've pushed that and hopefully by 2023, we'll have that up at 40% by most of the sports, which is really exciting. Like visibility, I think like our 2020 campaign, that wasn't ours. But, you know, I think the work that done did great job of putting things on the map. And I think lots of sports are really grasping hold of this principle of visibility, which is huge. And then our coaching representation, our participation, like they're huge, huge areas. And I think they're in general doing well. Nora Stapleton is the lead in Sport Ireland and she's just wonderful. Like she's just fundamentally why it's pushing forward. And I think her links with all of the sports and all of the women's representatives and all of the sports are really driving all of theirs. So I think Ireland is doing a great job. I think the leadership and governance is a key piece.
Yeah.
And what happens in the future, I think that will still drive. I think it needs to move down into actual management. You know, it's more high performance managers that are females and more CEOs and performance directors and more head coaches and so on. So I think that's probably the next era of it. Hmm. And that'll all come through opportunities and leadership that kind of believes that it's necessary. Because I think we've seen by the Sarah Keens of this world that, you know, female leadership is most certainly capable of being a driving force in a sport. And hopefully we just see more of it.
See more of it. And we've just seen the announcement of a new high performance director in the Irish women's rugby group. How do you see that benefiting the women's game here?
Yeah, look, I think it's great. I think Gillian McDarby, I don't know her well, but I think she'll do a great job. I think she's been in the system, so she knows the system. And I think as I said before, any code or country that's going to invest in the women's game with the right insights. And I think with the right insights is the really, really key piece. It's going to do well. We just need more. We've got loads, and I'm sure we all know of people, not only in women's sports, but, you know, in the GAA, there's lots of wonderful volunteers that are there that are just holding everything together, you know, that are the bagman and the gate man and the coach and the referee and all of that stuff. And in the women's game, we probably see too many of those, and although they're great, but you know, you need to have specific people employed to be able to do a good job at a strategic operational level. And so I think that's really good. Like, you'd hope to see more employments in the game to be able to drive the system properly. And as I said, the contracts are great, you know, they definitely reflect a professional direction. I think where we need to be careful with contracting is that we're still in an infrastructure build phase. So like, we need to invest in our domestic game. We need to have people working in, we need to attract excellent coaches into the women's game. This is absolutely key, full stop, around all of the codes, all of the world. If we don't drive the standards at a technical, tactical level of your ABCs, then the game is not going to produce what we know it can produce. So I think that infrastructure build is key, as opposed to just directly having to see like an end goal as we contract players and we're there. So I think once we take that approach and have a full, wholesome kind of program approach, then I think, Irish rugby will be in good space.
No, absolutely. I mean, and that's one side of it. If you think about the coaching, the infrastructure, players is obviously the other bit, right? And we touched a little bit on pathways and training ages and everything else, but I always look at, in particular, the Sevens program, which we're closer to, and the pathway for women and men and Sevens is very different, obviously, right? So it plays a very different role. And I think Sevens is a great if you like, window for people that maybe wouldn't be exposed to rugby to get a sense of something that they might enjoy playing at a younger age. And hopefully it's something that can encourage more women to participate in the game and get involved in that kind of high performance training earlier as well. Is that something that you see? And is there the equivalent pathways in South Africa, or is it very dependent on the regions and the provinces, as we touched on?
Yeah, it's a funny one. Like, I'm a big sevens fan. Like, I played it, and it's one of the things I maintain in the women's game. There is always, like with any new code, I think you'll always have this element of kind of either or competition between both. And I think we just need to, at a leadership level, be mature in our approach and recognize the difference. You know, the sevens game is very, very young. And as a result of it is very, very different. So I don't think we definitely shouldn't kind of rob Peter to play Paul. We should look at them both strategically and recognize the needs and the demands of each sport and how do we build that. So I love the, and I think World Rugby have a good bit to play in that. You know, when the sevens women's game kind of went more professional in 2012, because it was becoming an Olympic sport in 2016, I think the messaging globally was that the sevens game was the future. And I think that probably was the wrong messaging, because it straight away just put it off on a bad foot, and that's what its intentions was. Whereas, like, if you look at all of the sevens players and 15 players, they're very, very different. Yeah. And where you're going to get them from and how to develop them are very, very different. So, you know, we shouldn't be competing against each other. And I think the competition is obviously the finance pool and probably the talent pool as it builds. And as I said, I think if you deal with that maturely and strategically, I don't think they need to compete. So I think, yeah, like I think I really like the women's sevens are doing at the moment. Like, the girls are here actually in SAS. We just trained against them yesterday. And I look what Anthony Eddy did from a coaching point of view with those girls over the years was brilliant. There's no doubt that they are where they are because of their investment. And like we were talking about before, the performance environment that we created has created this, the girls playing as they are at the moment. So like, that's no coincidence. I do think that we have a long way to go to build back trust in the system, because I do think that's really important that it is done, because I don't think it needs to be an either or. There needs to be conflicting. I think they need to be respected for different codes and what they both bring, and recognize that, you know, the sevens game is an elite sport. You know, it isn't an inclusive sport. It is an elite sport. And as a result, you're not going to be able to have the inclusive reach that the 15 game does, because the 15th game represents everybody's shape and size and ability in the whole of every country. And sevens game doesn't. It's an elite sport. Yeah. And it's exceptionally wonderful and athletic. Whereas there's always kind of this kind of tussle between the two, which I don't think is healthy.
No,
and I really
100%.
Hope
yeah.
catch us hold of it at some stage to put it right, because, you know, we want to be able to support both.
No, exactly. No, that's really, really great insights, Lynn. Thank you. Thank you very much. And maybe just to wrap up, one last question, and you've been heavily involved in sport from a young age. I mean, if you were to think of one thing, what's the main learning that you've taken from that world of sport, and, you know, can it be applied anywhere elsewhere in your life?
Oh, Connor, one.
Just one thing.
After the conversation we've had.
Yeah.
Look, I suppose.
Bravery. Work ethic is what I would have taken from all of it, really, right? So tell me if I'm wrong with that one. Yeah.
Yeah, look, work ethic, absolutely. No, 100% work ethic. And I'm probably just the era that we're in from a women's sport point of view. I think you have to be brave. It doesn't matter that everybody's telling you that you're not important or you're not included. And if you feel like you are, then you have to be brave and speak out. And when you don't see things that are good or progressive, you have to call them out. So I think there's a bravery element piece in the women's sport story, and equally in just a sports person story. Be brave. Train hard, you know, apply that work ethic. And I think that takes bravery to be able to do it and push hard and make the sacrifices necessary in order to get there. So I kind of squeezed two qualities in there.
That's more. Okay. We'll let you away with that.
Paddy.
Very good. Thank you so much, Lynn. Really enjoyed that, and looking forward to seeing how South Africa get on. Probably, well, we don't know if we'll face each other at any point in the World Cup. You never know.
Yeah, that's true. I'll definitely be supporting both.
Great. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks, Connor.
So that's a wrap on episode 6 of Triton Lake Perform. Thank you for joining us. We hope you enjoyed it. We'll be back very soon with the final episode of this season.